Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 95 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Well, it's been 2 years since I started this podcast, so it's probably about time I get to one of the most loved and hated figures in history, Richard III. Whether it's love or hate, and there are plenty of people in both camps, Richard III is a king that has captured people's imaginations ever since his death on the battlefield at Bosworth. Not only is he Shakespeare's calculating villain shouting, "My kingdom for a horse!" but he's also the skeleton whose discovery beneath a parking lot made headlines around the world and brought together some of the most sophisticated and ingenious technologies used today. This week, I invited Chris Skidmore to speak with me about the enigmatic Richard III. In addition to being a longtime member of Parliament in the United Kingdom, Chris is the author of several books, including The Rise of the Tudors, Death and the Virgin Queen, and Edward VI, The Lost King of England. His latest book is Richard III, England's Most Controversial King. Here's our conversation about how Richard III went from being one of the most loyal subjects of the English crown to a usurper, and what, if anything, we know about the disappearance of the princes in the Tower. Thank you, Chris, for coming to talk to us about Richard III, who you call England's most controversial king. And I think you're probably onto something there. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to having a good chat today.
Yeah, me too. Now, there are a lot of kings in the Middle Ages that have the same names over and over again. So can you give us a little bit of context and tell us who Richard III is before we get into why he's a controversial figure?
Certainly. So Richard III was originally someone called Richard, Duke of Gloucester. Now, he was actually a younger son. He was never meant to be king. He was the son of someone called Richard, Duke of York, who rather controversially decided that the existing king, King Henry VI, should be replaced. And that kicked off what we now call the Wars of the Roses between Lancaster and York. So Richard III was a younger son on the House of York. But actually, it was his brother, Edward IV, who then took the throne in 1461. And so for a long time, Richard was a loyal younger brother of the House of York. But he then became Richard III in 1483. His brother died early that year, only aged 40, and his brother's son, Edward V, had come to the throne, aged only 13. And at that point, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, decided that he wanted to become Richard III. And he took the throne and reigned for only 2 years before he was then deposed at the Battle of Bosworth, which led to the birth of the Tudors, with Henry Tudor becoming Henry VII. So either way you look at it, Richard III is a really pivotal figure in English history. Most people think about him because of the controversy over what happened to Edward V and his brother Richard, the so-called Princes of the Tower. But he actually is a really interesting figure throughout his career, right from the early years when he becomes politically active, about 16, all the way to his death, which is why I wrote a book on him, really, because I sort of felt that he was someone who wasn't just worth focusing on as Richard III. He was somebody who was really pivotal to the 15th century.
And I think that comes through in the book, where when it comes to Richard III, people seem to have two camps, right? There are the people who think he's a monster, really kind of basing that a lot on, I think, Shakespeare's play about him. And then there's the people who will really work hard to rehabilitate them. And you decide to take a middle ground and really look at it carefully, right? So tell us a little bit about how his early years shaped Richard, because from the time he's about 8 years old, there's a huge conflict going on in England. So how does his early life sort of shape him into becoming the person who takes the throne later?
So, I mean, Richard's born in 1452, just at the moment when Henry VI, the current sort of Lancastrian king, is beginning to lose his mind, and that then leads to England spiralling into civil war during the 1450s. It then leads to Richard, at a very young age, about 8 years old, being forced into exile in the Netherlands. And I think for me, that's one of the key things about Richard. He has to grow up really early, because partly his father, Richard, Duke of York, is then sort of cast in exile himself. He then comes back to fight in a battle at Wakefield in 1459, 1460, and dies. And so Richard loses his father really early. He's abroad at that sort of time, and he eventually comes back and finds his brother is then on the throne. Things move so fast in terms of these battles that it's hard to keep up for the reader, let alone having to live through it. And Richard, then having been in exile in aged 8, is then becomes the Duke of Gloucester, is then suddenly brother to a king. And for the whole of the 1460s, I think struggles to find an identity because he's got sort of not only his elder brother, Edward IV, he's got another elder brother, George, Duke of Clarence, who's heir to the throne. And then Richard plays his cards probably as best he can. And there is a situation where actually Henry VI comes back onto the throne, having been supported by Warwick the Kingmaker. I mean, it's terribly complex. But ultimately, what's important to recognise is that Richard, as a younger brother, backs his brother. George, Duke of Clarence, goes off and backs Warwick and Henry VI, a sort of troublesome sort of character. But Richard then goes back into exile, age 17, into the Netherlands, and then comes back with Edward IV and fights these two battles, the Battles of Barnet and the Battles of Tewkesbury, which he leads the vanguard for and wins both battles. And he's an incredibly successful general, and his brother then rewards him after these battles, once his brother comes back onto the throne. So by the time Richard is 18, you know, most of us would be just starting university. He has then sort of lived this remarkable life already, which would probably take up an entire person's lifetime, where he has been sort of thrown out of the country twice. He's come back. He's been given sort of all the riches, a nobleman who's the brother of a king. He's then come back and, against all odds, won these two battles. So, you know, even by 18, he's already on his way to being one of the most important men in the kingdom.
And I think that's a good place to get to where he starts to be a controversial figure, because it's around 18 when he's just won these battles and they've recaptured Henry VI, and Henry VI is in the tower. And this is when Richard starts to get himself mired in rumor and controversy. So what happens to Henry VI in the tower, and how is that connected to Richard?
That's absolutely right. So we have the sort of Battle of Tewkesbury that takes place on the 4th of May, 1471. And it's quite sort of controversial in terms of what happens to the heir of the Lancastrian dynasty, someone called Prince Edward, who's the son of Henry VI. And he dies in the battle. And there are reports that perhaps he was captured and that he was then executed afterwards, and that Richard was potentially responsible in that sort of execution. There's a famous painted scene in a book that shows Richard sort of holding up the prince. And several days later, I think on the 22nd of May, 1471, Henry VI is found dead in the Tower of London. You know, Edward IV has come back, marched into London triumphant. Richard joined him. And I guess the question is, with all historical controversies, it's a question of sources and looking at the sources and when they're written. Many sources are written after Richard III's been on the throne, so often they then tend to blame Richard for everything that goes on. But it does seem that Richard was present in the Tower of London when Henry VI died. He didn't just die of natural causes, it seems, although that's what the Yorkists wanted to dress it up as, that he died of grief, finding out about his son dying in the Battle of Tewkesbury. But apparently, quite critically, when the coffin was bleeding blood, as if his body had suffered some sort of mortal wounds. And even in the archaeological excavations that had taken place in the early 20th century, when they dug up Henry VI's skeleton, it certainly had sort of head wounds to the skull, which suggests there had been some kind of violent trauma. So I think it's definitely the case that Henry VI was killed. And probably why not? Because Edward IV had allowed him to survive after he first took the throne, and he just caused nothing but mischief for the next 10 years. And so I think Edward IV had sort of had enough. And it has to be ultimately Edward IV's responsibility, probably, that he decided to get rid of his rival king. If Richard was involved, he did so from the orders of his brother. But there's no escaping the fact that potentially Richard was involved in some way or another with this king's death in the tower.
He was a constable in the tower at the time, wasn't he? And that's kind of where people started to talk about it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think to ascribe to Richard, whether it was him or whether it was one of his men who may have decided to dispatch the king, they would have done so on the king's orders. There had been enough occasions where Henry VI, having been deposed from the realm, was going to be probably executed at some stage anyway, I think. It's just the way it's sort of written up. going through to Shakespeare, obviously, where it's then seen as sort of Richard as being some kind of murderous sort of tyrant who decided to take the decision himself. I think he probably wouldn't have taken that decision, but may have been involved in the death. And I think there's no shame in saying that. I mean, I think what the problem is, you've mentioned this sort of decision of sort of black or white, that somehow Richard is innocent of every crime, or he's somehow guilty of every crime. There is a middle ground here, which is that he could have been involved in the murder. And if he was, that's not to somehow be anti-Richard. It's to say that he was doing what was asked of him by his brother because he was a loyalist to the regime.
And he remained loyal for the longest time, which I think is what makes what he does when his brother dies so surprising to everyone. So I think that there's so much that happens to Richard in the years between. But I think that for the sake of time, we should get to the point at which Edward IV has just died and Richard finds this out. He has a mass for his brother up in York, and then he starts to come down. And what happens when he comes down from York?
Yeah, so 9th of April, 1483, Edward IV died suddenly. He's just turned 40. No one's expecting it. He seems to have time to make a will. And I think this is a key point in Richard's motivations, because the way I view it, 1483, is not Richard having some kind of master plan. He comes down to London, he's going to take the throne. But he basically is fighting again still for his brother's memory and his brother's rights. And it seems that his brother makes a last will and testament, which he declares that he wants Richard to be his son's protector. So that Prince of Wales is going to become Edward V, but he wants Richard as his paternal uncle to become the protector. Unfortunately, the young king has been brought up by the Woodvilles, Elizabeth Woodville, the queen, his mother, for the past 10 years. And he's been in Ludlow in Wales as Prince of Wales. So Richard hasn't really seen Edward V for several years, but he's determined to ensure that his brother's will is carried out. So he comes down to London. He's been in contact with someone called the Duke of Buckingham, who's also a prominent nobleman. And he decides to write to the new king and his retinue in the Woodvilles to say, well, let's meet outside London, all come into London together, and then we can ensure that there's sort of stability for the future. And that seems like a good prospect and potentially a sort of harmonious way to deal with the situation. But I think what Richard isn't expecting is potentially the hostility from the Woodvilles to his own plan to simply follow the king's last will. And I think that's where sort of Richard begins to come unstuck, is that he thinks that simply by following the law to the letter, being law to the letter, will be enough. But it's not, because he's got sort of the Woodvilles to contend with. And that's where things begin to go wrong.
I think it's interesting because Edward V is one of the princes in the Tower, who we'll get to in a second. But it wasn't until reading your book that I realized that he was very much his own man, even though he was 13. He stands up to Richard and says, I don't want to do things your way. And I didn't realize that he was doing a lot of administration in his own name, because we always kind of picture him as being a child, and he is a child, but he is much more grown up in a lot of ways than maybe we might expect at 13. So he's standing up to Richard. What does Richard do next?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. And one of the key things that we need to understand is that we see these portraits, the Millet portraits of the princes in the Tower, and they look like these angelic sort of blonde little children. And we view the princes as if they are children. But as I mentioned earlier, you know, Richard was already at the age of 10, quite actively involved in politics, and people grew up fast during this period. And that's the same with Edward V. And there's definite proof that even when he was Prince of Wales, powers were being given so that he could be beaten if he answered back, and it demonstrates he's beginning to be quite a truculent teenager, age 13. So he comes out, and when Richard arrests his other uncle, Lord Woodville, who's been his protector for the past 10 years, and said, look, I'm now going to look after you, Edward V challenges Richard and says, no, actually, I want my uncle back, thank you very much. And I think Richard realizes at this point that actually he's got a problem on his hands with the young king, that he could be the protector of the young king. And he goes into London with the young king, and he's made protector, and they arrange for a coronation for Edward V that's going to take place on the 25th of June. But Richard begins to realise that actually, even if he's protector, once the king becomes king, he'll have the power of taking Richard into his own hands and maybe taking revenge for Richard seizing the king and telling him that he's now going to be his protector. So I think he's placed in a really sort of difficult situation about what to do next. And that's the sort of way I view this whole sequence of events for the months of 1483, is that we have this period then where it looks as if everything's fine. Richard's come down. He's now the king's protector. Things are carrying on as normal. But behind the scenes, it seems that a number of members of the nobility, not just Richard, I think that's also another key thing to remember. And one of the things I sort of reflect in terms of my own political experience is that Richard didn't just take the throne by himself. He must have had support to be able to do so. And I think people begin to realize that Edward V is not his father's son. He's actually a product of the Woodvilles, he's the queen. And actually they begin to really worry, well, what will this mean for the future? We'll have this young king who will basically give carte blanche to this sort of Woodville family who the nobility have never got on with. They're sort of parvenus. They're not from noble blood. That actually they'll do their own thing and run riot and ultimately put all their own favourites in charge. And I think, yeah, that's extremely worrying. And people maybe begin to think, well, do we really want a child on the throne? Maybe it might be better if we allow Richard. And I think these calculations are beginning to emerge during a period, even when they're preparing for the young king's coronation.
Yeah, I think that's right. When I think about this, I was reading your book and thinking in Shakespeare, you know, Richard has this plan from the beginning. He's going to take the throne. But it actually is a lot more like Macbeth, where it's one situation after the other and it just keeps snowballing. And Richard is, he's not exactly trying to keep up because he is kind of an instigator in a lot of ways. But it seems to almost get away from him, the decisions that he's making. So what are some of the things that happen after he gets there? He's in conflict with Edward V and he starts to arrange things, I think, at that point to make it so that he can take the throne. So how does that work out?
Yeah, it seems that I think Richard also becomes quite paranoid in thinking that potentially there are conspiracies that are now being developed against him. Queen Elizabeth Woodville has fled into Sanctuary. So as soon as she found out that Richard was coming to London, she heads into Sanctuary in Westminster Abbey. So she takes with her the younger prince, Prince Richard, Duke of York. And so the coronation can't really take place with her and her younger son in Sanctuary. So Richard's desperate for them to come out of Sanctuary. And he tries and she refuses. And ultimately, it seems that while she's in Sanctuary, and I look at this in my book, I think she sort of reaches out to various members of the nobility. And it seems that one of the key members of the nobility is someone who Richard thought he could trust, someone called William Lord Hastings. And he was the chamberlain of the king's household. So he's got quite a lot of power amongst Edward IV's former household men. And it seems that through a sort of complex web of individuals, not least potentially one of Edward IV's former mistresses, Elizabeth Shore, that he manages to reach out to the queen and establish a relationship with the queen, even in Sanctuary. And Richard seems to find out about this. And suddenly, on Friday the 13th of June, he arrests Hastings at a council meeting and has him executed immediately outside on the green in the Tower of London. And partly it goes to show, I think, that while Richard is forced into taking sudden decisions, you know, he decided to execute Hastings very suddenly. The way he acts is very sudden. He clearly acts in a way that's outside the normal parameters of political behaviour, because how does he manage to arrest Anthony Woodville? He suddenly springs a surprise on him and arrests him before they come into London. He manages to suddenly spring this surprise on Hastings. But Hastings' arrest then leads to the light of the touch paper, which then it begins this process by which Richard can't go back. He may have been looking still for a way by which he could be the king's protector, but the coronation on the 25th of June is rapidly approaching, and it seems that after Hastings' arrest, Richard decides that he's going to seize the throne. And 3 days later, on Monday the 16th of June, he sort of effectively forces the queen to hand over her younger son by surrounding the sanctuary with armed guards and troops. So she hands over the younger son. As soon as that's taken place, the coronation is cancelled. And the Sunday when the coronation was meant to take place, instead, someone gets up, Ralph Shah, a preacher, and makes a sermon declaring that the two sons of Edward IV are illegitimate and therefore they can't take the throne. And that in itself is quite a controversial decision, but that begins this process of then Richard beginning to frame his decision to take the throne. He's not quite ready to do it, but he begins now to say, this is where we've got to go.
I think that you mentioned in the book that he shows up at that sermon, doesn't he? And he's listening to it. So I think he's probably trying to gauge the feeling of the people. And it reminds me of how his father had appeared at Parliament and expected everyone to appreciate him and make him the king. And so I'm thinking about this in terms of Richard listening to the sermon and thinking, oh, this is maybe they're not on board with this as much as I had realized.
Yeah, and I think Richard learns the lesson from his father, who went up to the throne and put his hand on it and thought it was his, and then realized that no one was going to support him. And I think looking at how Richard acts in the next couple of days, he doesn't put himself forward in the same way his father did. He's learned from that. He's sort of testing the ground and trying to find a solution that is going to allow for the deposition of Edward V properly. And there are various supporters of Richard III who will say, well, actually, he was right to do it because there was something called the pre-contract that Edward IV had signed with another lady, which basically he promised to marry somebody else before he then actually married Elizabeth Woodville. And this dates back to the early 1460s. And supposedly someone called Robert Stillington, the Bishop of Bath and Wales, appears and says to Richard, well, I took part and officiated this ceremony, which under medieval canon law means that actually the marriage between Edward and his queen is invalid because he was already betrothed to somebody else. And as a result, all the issue, all the children from that marriage were illegitimate. So therefore, here is the means by which you can say Edward and his brother are illegitimate and can't be the king for the future. And therefore, Richard, you'll have to be king. And that's all very convenient. And for those people who support Richard III, this is a really identifiable means by which they can say, well, he was right to do this. But when you look at the contemporary evidence, actually, that sermon on that Sunday didn't set out that the children were illegitimate. It actually set out that Edward IV himself was illegitimate. And that actually the sermon talks about how Edward IV was sort of blonde and tall, and Richard, Duke of Gloucester, looked like his father, unlike his brother Edward. And it sort of inferred that actually, Edward IV was illegitimate because his mother had had an affair with a French archer. And it seems that this theory was tested out, but no one seems to have actually asked Richard's mother, Cecily, what she thought about it. So there were really difficult conversations were had at that point. And then it seems that there's another theory that's put out. And we know this by the most contemporary account by someone called Dominic Mancini, who writes an almost contemporary version of events by the 1st of December, 1483. Where it seems that there's a theory that Edward IV was promised to be married to Bona of Savoy, a foreign bride. And it's not till version three emerges several days later about this pre-contract theory that they settle on this. And maybe, you know, Robert Stillington came forward with the proposals. But everyone must have known about it, probably. And everyone knew that Edward IV was a playboy and certainly had his witty way with a number of ladies, widows at court, and would have been of no surprise to everyone. So it's almost a sort of convenient vehicle by which then a decision ex post facto, we found the solution that's going to deliver the decision that's already been taken. And I think that's very much the way I sort of look at it, is that Richard had decided he wanted to take the throne and was just looking for the escape clause by which how to present it.
And I think that everybody who was there at the time realized that, whether they decided to go along with it or not. But the problem is there is still a king in the tower. He's prince. At this point, he hasn't had a coronation. So what happens to the princes in the tower? This is the moment that people have probably been waiting for on the medieval podcast for 2 years. What do you think happened to the princes in the tower?
It's very difficult to disaggregate the sources here from contemporary events, because we know Dominic Mancini, who I mentioned, talks about how people were crying, saying they weren't sure what happened to the princes. We know from the Great Chronicle of London that was written up slightly later, that the princes had been seen playing with bows and arrows in the garden of the tower, and then suddenly they were more secluded and not seen again. We know from contemporary evidence that on the 18th of July that payments were made to Edward V's servants, who were then released from service, so he'd lost his servants. But it seems that the princes were still alive in the tower, but there was an attempt to free them. And we know this from several records, which demonstrate that there were four gentlemen who were arrested and suddenly tried and executed for attempting to free the princes, setting fires in London elsewhere as a distraction mechanism. Richard had gone on a tour of the country. So on the 29th of July, 1483, he writes a letter talking about an enterprise lately committed by which the guilty parties were in prison already. So it seems that sort of end of July, there's this attempt to free the princes in the Tower. It goes wrong, or at least doesn't succeed. And that, I think, becomes the next means by which Richard realises that he can't maybe keep the two boys alive. Now, of course, the evidence for their deaths, the most detailed is Thomas More, who sort of sets out much later, from 1515 onwards, a version of the individuals who might have been involved: James Tyrrell, John Green, John Dighton, Miles Forrest. And I'm really interested in actually unpicking this, because I think probably in the past, everyone's seen More as literary fiction. Actually, you know, we know from the discovery of Richard's body, everyone used to say, well, the fact that he's a hunchback is fictional. How would he have won all these battles if he was disabled in this way? And we now know that Richard did have a severe form of scoliosis from the discovery of his body in the car park. You can see the curvature of the spine. And so there are elements of More that are true. And so I think it's worthwhile, you know, reinvestigating the More story. And I'm, you know, very interested in tracking those individuals. We know from Miles Forrest that More talked about how he died regretting the decision he took to play a part in killing the princes in probably August 1483. And there are payments by Richard to More's widow, Joanne, in September 1484 for a pension for 5 years as a result of Miles's service. So we know that Miles Forrest exists. I've also been able to track down John Green, who we know is a valet in the Duke's service. So you actually begin to piece together that actually maybe More may be historically correct than we know. Tim Thornton's just published an article that's come out tracking down John Dighton and the children of Miles Forrest. It may be that Thomas More had spoken to them about potentially their father's involvement in the prince's death. But ultimately, the clearest evidence for the people believing the prince was just for dead. And I think for me, that's what I tried to show in the book. I didn't go into too much details about what happened to the princes, because it does rely on using quite later sources in order to infer what happened to them. And there are so many different versions of whether they were drowned, whether they had a pillow over their faces. But it's clear that people believed they were dead. And I think that's the most important thing to recognize here, is that, okay, yes, some people believed they were still alive. And certainly pretenders like Perkin Warbeck came back claiming that he was the younger son, Richard, Duke of York. But even Perkin Warbeck still claimed that Richard III had Edward V killed. And there are plenty of Yorkists who got involved with Perkin Warbeck's cause. I don't believe that Perkin Warbeck was the younger prince in the Tower by any means, but people were believed in rumours. And Henry VII then was desperate to suppress any rumours, and he didn't want to release any version of what happened to the princes, because it didn't help his cause. Because if he released a version of what happened to them, he would then legitimise his wife's own cause, and it's very difficult for Henry. He wants to basically just claim he is victor by battle and by God's judgment and leave it at that. So is it that he has no interest in opening up the past when it comes to the history of what happens to the princes. But it does help his cause in September 1483, because there's this huge rebellion against Richard suddenly. Everyone who was on Edward IV's household supports Richard's coronation on the 6th of July 1483, whether through fear, whether through sort of knowing that Richard's got too many troops and forces in London, that it's inevitable that they can't turn against him. But 2 months later, in September, they all suddenly decide to turn against Richard. And why do they do that? I think it's because they learned that the princes are dead. And that's why they don't have a rebellion to bring back the princes, in the same way you had this sort of rising to try and free them at the end of July. Instead, they turn to Henry Tudor, who has got a fairly distant claim to the throne. But Henry seems to have promised that he'll marry the prince's sister, Elizabeth of York, in order to continue the Yorkist dynasty. And they do that because they know that the princes are dead. And for better or worse, they have to decide what they're going to do. And they decide they're going to back Henry Tudor to come back from exile in France to become their king. That, for me, is the clearest evidence that actually the princes are dead.
Yeah. I think that's important to recognize that everyone believed it, and it is definitely plausible. And the thing is about this situation is it's so much a product of its time, because Richard has seen the trouble that Henry VI made for his brother for years. Of course, it would make sense to him to dispatch of these other claimants to the throne. And that's very much product of the time, because people didn't take this type of thing lightly. And the other thing that I think that is important that you mention is that people were accepted the fact that Richard was taking the throne. They expected it in a way, but they were allowing it in part, I think, because the princes, they thought they were still alive and that things could change really easily, as they had seen been changing for the last few decades. And so allowing Richard to take the throne, it might not have been something that would have happened so quickly and bloodlessly if people hadn't seen the changeover of power so frequently over the last 20 or 30 years. It's really an interesting moment, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I think there's a lot more work can be done on looking at this sort of 1483, because we all look at it in isolation, but you have to see it in that chain of events. And actually, the titulus regis that's used later on in January 1484 in the Parliament to justify Richard's claim to the throne and why he's king, and it sets out sort of obviously this whole pre-contract theory for why that Edward and his brother were deposed, why they were bastards. That's the phrase used in all the sort of documentation at the time. You know, it seems quite similar to 1469 and the Earl of Warwick's decision to overturn Edward IV. And I do think the individuals at the time who were sort of looking for templates of how to act do look back to the recent past. And also the recent past has shown that if you have a child on the throne, as is what happened with Henry VI in the past, it creates a vacuum of power and instability. And yeah, woe unto thee whose land is king as a child, I think is the biblical phrase in the book of Josiah. And people do reflect on that. And I think Richard has proven himself as a military general time and time again, a solid leader who can win battles. He's been highly successful in victories in Scotland, for example. But he seems a dependable character on which to base the future security of the realm. People go along with this until the moment where they find out that Richard has killed the princes. And why is that so horrific? Because it reflects then on the nature of tyranny. If Richard can kill children, he will stop at nothing in future. So maybe nobody's own lands are secure if the king is a tyrant. And I think that's the key point here, is the death of children is something different in medieval society. And a child killer is viewed as a Herod-like king. And I think Richard then outsteps the normal bounds of society, even in a bloody society that had been scarred by civil war. To kill children was something that was an anathema. And that's where I think Richard goes wrong. People then quickly turn against him in a way that maybe they wouldn't have done if he'd kept them alive. It would have been a difficult balancing act, because, yes, the children would have matured and become adults and potentially been the focus of future rebellions and conspiracies. But if you compare, for instance, what happens with Henry VII, Clarence's son, Edward, Earl of Warwick, is kept alive in the Tower for many a year. And then once he reaches his maturity and becomes a fully grown adult, Henry dispatches him along with Perkin Warbeck in 1499. So even Henry VII realizes that it's not the done thing to kill a child or a young adult, but obviously he does so later on.
Yeah, that's a really good point to make, where there is the same situation for Henry VII and he deals with it in a completely different way. I do want to get into the fact that propaganda and rumor are huge in Richard's story. We have a lot of Yorkist propaganda, during the whole reign of the Yorks. And then there's the Tudor propaganda after that. But rumors were really dangerous to Richard, even when he was the king. And at one point, he has to actually address the people and address his council when they are accusing him of poisoning his wife later on. So how do rumors and propaganda really figure in Richard's story?
That's right. So Richard is quite unfortunate in that after he crushes this rebellion and gets his title proclaimed by Parliament, a couple of weeks later, his son dies in April 1484, and almost a year later, his wife then dies in March 1485. So he's then left without an heir or a wife to beget another heir. People must have been thinking, well, God's judgment's not really on your side in this particular instance. But you've got Henry Tudor is then abroad in France. And what happens is all those rebels who, you know, Richard seems like he's got a great victory in 1483, but actually it's sowed the seeds of his defeat. It's a completely Pyrrhic victory because everyone who takes part in the rebellion then flees abroad and joins Henry Tudor's court in exile. And this exiled court is beginning then to sort of reach into England and foment new rebellion and conspiracy and dissent. And that includes rumours, obviously, about Richard's conduct. And I compare this a bit like to sort of the birth of social media today, because what you've also got happening is the birth of the printing press. So you've got William Caxton as a printer, you know, beginning to print books at this particular time. But you've got other printed bills being produced. So it's not just handwritten literature that's being distributed. There seems to be, although nothing survives, printed bills being cast in London, accusing the king of various things. And Richard's incredibly touchy about it. And someone called William Collingbourne is found guilty of putting up just a rhyme, which is sort of the rat, the cat and the dog, which represent sort of Richard's three advisors, Francis Lord Lovell, William Catesby, Richard Ratcliffe, all lieth under the hog, which was Richard's insignia. And that's pinned on the walls of the doors of St. Paul's in London, St. Paul's Cathedral. Anyway, Collingbourne's arrested and is hung, drawn and quartered, taking the most savage form of execution, where he is hung and then he has his bowels cut open while he's still alive, after being cut down from being sort of almost asphyxiated and having his bowels sort of pulled out and then chucked in a fire. Anyway, it goes to show how seriously Richard sort of treats these sort of instances of rumour and seditious words. But it seems that sort of there are accusations that Richard poisoned his wife when she probably died of tuberculosis. It seems there are accusations then that Richard's on the hunt for a new bride, of which one candidate is his own niece, Elizabeth, Duke of York, Edward IV's daughter, who Henry Tudor is interested in marrying in order to then claim the throne and unite the houses of Lancaster and York. And Richard has to publicly deny that he's going to marry his own niece. I don't think he was planning to. It seems all the evidence was that he was planning a Portuguese marriage, if possible. But that, you know, rumours are powerful enough. And it goes to show, I think, how medieval society was similar and also not similar to our own society, because, you know, all it takes is a rogue tweet on Twitter to be liked thousands and tens of thousands of times for somebody to then put out a retraction, but then no one reads the retraction and the tweet has gone viral. And I think it was very much the same in medieval times, that people were willing to believe rumours. Rumours may have been false, but people were willing to believe them because probably they also recognised that Richard had a role in the prince's death. And the Great Chronicle's quite clear. He's got it, timelines are confused in the Great Chronicle, but it links the prince's death at the same time with Richard's wife's death. And it must have been conversationally, people must have been bringing this up and linking the two. So I think the fact is that people recognised that Richard had seized the throne, that potentially they didn't know what happened to the princes, but they knew that they were dead. And then if he was capable of that, well, of course he was capable of marrying his niece, wasn't he? Because he was an abomination. And I think sort of Richard was losing the propaganda war. We know that Henry Tudor was sending in bills against Richard, because Richard writes a letter to all the mayors and towns in England urging them to confiscate these bills and to sort of arrest anyone who was seen distributing them.
Such an interesting time, because there's a whole lot of written evidence, and yet it's still very difficult to pin down anybody's mindset. And that's kind of something that is almost unique in this, when you look at the Middle Ages, because we're right at the end of the Middle Ages and it's possible to find all these written sources, but difficult to know somebody's mindset. So I'm going to ask you a really difficult question. And that is, do you think that Richard, in his own mind, justified this to himself? Do you think that he really did think that he was doing something good for the people by becoming the king?
Yeah, I think Richard had a sort of sense of his own identity grounded within a sort of providential system. So he believed that he was doing God's work. He was highly pious, and we know that from sort of all his bequests and foundations, religious foundations he set up. When he took actions as a king, he was quite driven by a sense of justice, that he took his duties incredibly seriously. So I don't think it's mutually exclusive to suggest that Richard recognized his kingship as an opportunity to put into practice some of the quite virtuous things he'd done in the past. But I think it goes to show that he recognized his role as king as being one that he took seriously and that he was in it for the long term. Richard, being Richard, would have probably thought he had no alternative to do what he had done, that it had been kill or be killed. Once the pre-contract theory had been presented to him, he could buy into that and he could see that through medieval canon law, he was doing the right thing. And the way it's expressed about Edward the Bastard, you know, throughout all the documentation, I think Richard would have definitely convinced himself that he had done the right thing in God's eyes. And that goes right the way up even to the Battle of Bosworth and Richard's final moments when he decides to go into that battle wearing the crown on his head, because I think he sees Henry Tudor as a rebel and he sees it as his duty to crush this rebellion, and that if God is going to be on his side, he'll win the day. So I genuinely think Richard believes this. We have his prayer book that survives remarkably, that he took to the Battle of Bosworth and was found in his tent after his defeat. And in that prayer book, it has a prayer in which Richard prays to God to help him defeat his enemies and those who have turned against him. So I think probably he's a bit like a Richard Nixon type of character, I think, when it comes to sort of he entirely believes in his cause, and he believes that there are those who are scheming against him, and he can't quite understand why these individuals are doing this when he is taking up God's cause.
That's the impression that I have of him as well from looking at the evidence. And I think that he's going to remain a controversial king forever, even though we found his skeleton, we found his prayer books, we found a lot of his writing as well. I think he's going to remain controversial. But I wanted to thank you so much for talking through your ideas about Richard for the podcast. So thank you so much, Chris.
Not at all. Thanks for being in contact, and really enjoyed it. So really good to be on the podcast, and happy to come back anytime.
Thank you. Appreciate it. To find out more about Chris's work, you can follow him on Twitter at Bosworth Battle. You can find Richard III, England's most controversial king, as well as all of Chris's other books on Amazon. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey. Well, we have a bit of sad news to kind of start off to let you know about. Two people that were really involved in medieval studies and the medieval world passed away last week. Giles Constable, historian of 12th and 13th century, he did lots of things: monasticism, crusades, the 12th century Renaissance. He was really well known for the last, I'd say, 60 years doing work. He just passed away, and so did Sharon K. Penman, famed novelist. So we're kind of sad to see that. And you can read a bit about them and their lives and what they contributed to medieval history and medieval world. We also have a new columnist on medievalist.net. It's Kelly DeVries. Many of you might know him as like this military historian, and he's very prolific. We finally got him to be a kind of a ongoing contributor to us. And you should check out his piece. It's about the Battle of Campo del Lino in the 13th century. So it's a lot of fun. We also have Elizabeth Smith Rosser talking about abstaining from alcohol in medieval China this week. So we've got all that on the website.
Wow, that is a full week. And I'm sure people are going to be paying tribute to those fallen heroes this week. And it's great that Kelly DeVries is going to be writing for medievalist.net, because he is something, and it's going to be great to see his work.
Yeah. He's someone I think has got a million stories in him. And like the first one is no exception. And also, hey, if you're on TikTok, we are actually on TikTok now. Some video stuff and me just goofing off. So
I can't wait to see it. I haven't seen it yet, so I'm looking forward to that too.
I can't wait to do the dances.
Yeah, I think that we all need to see that, or maybe not. All right. Okay. Well, thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you to all of our patrons on patreon.com for keeping this podcast going. Every little bit of your support is most appreciated. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast get access to all sorts of stuff like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and maps made just for us by Tina Ross. If you'd like to find out more about how to become a patron, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from controversial kings to tributes to the giants in our field, Follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. To find Peter's videos on TikTok, look for at medievalists.net. Although I'm not doing TikTok dances, you can still follow me, Danielle Cebulski, elsewhere on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.